Hello, and welcome to this Innovation Forum webinar. I'm Ian Welsh in London, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so. Today, we're going to discuss how audits can work to tackle human rights violations. It's fair to say that auditing is one of those things that everyone accepts is essential, but seems happy to criticise in equal measure. Indeed, as Churchill might have said, the general consensus too often seems to be that auditing may be the worst way of monitoring supply chains, apart from all the other methods. But is this fair? This webinar will attempt to take a realistic look at the challenges surrounding auditing and how processes must adapt to ensure audits are an effective tool to tackle human rights violations. As ever, we have an expert panel to frame our discussion this afternoon. We have Terry Olano, Senior Business Development Manager with Kima. We have Vera Galarza, Senior Director, Ethics and Compliance with Aldo. Gabriella Vass, Senior Impact Manager, Human Rights Specialist at Twinings. And Verity Lawson, Senior International Sustainability Manager with British American Tobacco. Over the next hour, we'll assess how these companies are leveraging AI, data analytics, and other tools to uncover potential human rights violations, and we will debate the extent to which audits can assist and complement these processes. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Natasha Bodnar, for helping to convene our panel today, and to Kima for sponsoring this webinar. And the issues we're covering now will also be part of the discussion at Innovation Forum's next conference on ethical trade and human rights in London on the 18th and 19th of March. Full details of the already impressive participant lineup and how to attend are on the Innovation Forum website via the link on your screen now. Okay, I will shortly invite our panelists to answer some opening questions to kick things off. We will have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to audience questions. We do want to hear from you all, so please submit questions using the question box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Questions can be directed to all the panel or to one panelist in particular. And if you keep your questions short and to the point, it is more likely that I will use them. As usual, for Innovation Forum sessions, we have no slides or presentations today, just discussion. We are taping the hour, and you will receive a link to the recording in due course when it is published. Okay. Terry, perhaps you can go first. Can you set the scene for us and outline the most important trends in human rights auditing processes and how you think they are improving their effectiveness? Terry.
Hi, Ian. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Tackling human rights is a very complicated thing to try to achieve. But before we can even try to tackle it, we have to know what human rights is and how to spot human rights. So no matter who is doing the auditing, the most important thing that is the most important tool in your box is education and to know what to look for and what to spot in order to be able to make an impact on any human rights violations. And I just wanted to give you a little fact and then I'm going to go into some tools that we use. So the fact is human rights, there are over 42 million people living in modern slavery conditions in the world. Modern slavery can be defined as exploited labor, government forced labor, forced marriage, and these are all parts of human rights violations. The more we can educate the auditors that we work with, the better they are at spotting these violations. So like I said before, one of the best tools you can do is prior to the audit to have really great education for your team. Couple practices that Kima does is we do something called an ethical watch. We do research on the audited site that we're going to be going to, and we look for anything that has come up with that site from government authorities, newspapers, and we try to identify any past legal actions or bad press that have happened at the facility so that we can start looking into different things a little better when we get to the facility. We also rely heavily on our ethical compliance industry. A lot of ethical compliance companies will share information when they find human rights violations or very very bad things that they have found in the industry. And we rely on our auditors. We also rely on, like I said, people in the industry to help us get better educated for the areas that we're going to. So, you know, auditing is something, like Ian said, that nobody wants to do, but it's a necessary evil. And you know, there is a process that's followed during audits to try to get through the factory and review the records and see if there's any underlying problems. A few things that we do that are kind of a little different. We believe in doing a double sampling process for the interviews. So what that means is our auditors will go in, they will do a first round of interviews as more of a survey to find some potential issues and trends. They'll ask some open-ended questions. They'll see if they can actually find a problem or something that may not be quite right. Okay. The feeling that it's not quite right. And then they'll take that information from the interviews, and then they'll dig deeper through document reviews. They'll review their interview notes, and then we'll do a second round of interviews. During the second round of interviews, we will focus on one or two topics that we feel may be potential issues, very strategic open-ended questions. So the interviewees will really elaborate on some of the areas that we feel might be a possible problem. A couple other things that are a little different. We do something called a night audit. And the objective of a night audit is to verify if the factory is really being transparent and recording all of their working hours. Working hours always tend to be a big issue during audits. So what we'll do is we'll send an auditor unannounced to observe the factory during the night and see if there's any work taking place. The auditor doesn't enter the factory. They won't meet anybody. The factory doesn't know we're there. We go in about 2 weeks before the actual audit and just observe, take notes, see what's going on. And then when we send the team back in 2 weeks later, we will request the working hours and records for the specific day that they were at the facility looking, observing at night. And we'll review the team during the interview process to make sure that the information that we get from both the record review and the interviewees match what we have seen. In addition to that, we also will do a neighborhood audit. The objective of that is to get more information about the practices of the factory through discussions with the neighborhood shops and businesses. So the auditor on the day of the audit will, maybe at lunchtime, they'll go out to take their lunch break, and they might go to some of the businesses around the area and just kind of ask questions, you know, about the neighboring business, what they see every day, the working hours, do they see a lot of people coming and going, some activity. So we try to use some different techniques to really try to tackle the problem and see if there is a problem.
Thank you, Terry. Thinking in terms of technology, so many people, or so many arguments you hear around business, say that technology is the kind of the thing that's going to change everything that we do. What are the areas of technology that are really helping and developing in auditing? Is there much use of artificial intelligence, for example?
Yes. So, you know, so Kima at its core is a technology-based QC company. So we do like to share that information, and we do use that to its full extent. We use something called a worker voice solution. We're partnered with, and I never say this right, Ulula. Which is a well-known company. We developed some surveys for workers that we have them go in and fill out some anonymous surveys when they're off-site. We try to use technology that way. We try to really put a grievance hotline into place. Anything we can do to have the workers open up. And what we do when we're using all these like voice solutions or grievance hotline, we gather the information and we put it into the customer database, and we create a trend or a report for the client so they can see what information we're able to gather outside of the audit the actual audit day, the audit process.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Terry. That's great. There's so much there we can come back to, but I'm keen to bring in the rest of the panel. Vera, let me turn to you. What are you doing to highlight human rights and labour abuses in your operations and supply chains, and what extent do audits help you right now? Vera.
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for inviting me to this very interesting panel. I would like to give a bit of an overview of myself. Also, I started in the industry already 15 years ago as a social compliance auditor based in Spain. And I have conducted more than 1,000 audits in more than 50 countries, representing several brands, different industries, having to follow a diverse amount of standards, as well as using IT in different ways or very simple Word documents to provide the report. And being based in Europe and speaking Spanish gave me the possibility to visit factories almost worldwide, which helped me to understand the needs and the scale the factories are at. So this could help us to really get a better overview of what tools do we need to adapt to really understand the working conditions and maybe implement improvements programs. A few years ago, I moved to a brand, and now I'm overseeing the responsible sourcing program within Aldo. And in Aldo, we seriously believe in developing long-term, mutually beneficial business partners founded on transparency, trust, and collaboration. And we also feel that it's our responsibility to help factories and strengthen their management practices to drive sustainable change in our supply chain. So audits is one of our main tools to understand this and to ensure that the factories are adhered to the legal requirements, respect our standards, and provide a safe and healthy work environment. But it doesn't stay only on auditing. We are going also beyond that. Together with different internal departments, we ensure to help factories in taking ownership in their sustainable performance, provide guidance, training, manuals, and provide diverse workshops so that we can really support and ensure that there's continuous improvements. We have several summits, and we also do not do this alone. So we are engaging with different partners, including multi-stakeholders. We are part of the SLCP to also collaborate with other brands and other governments, NGOs, to make sure that we are all together in this journey.
Thank you very much indeed. Same question to you that I put to Terry. How are you seeing technology helping improving your relationships with suppliers through auditing?
In our case, we are using a lot of different softwares to data analysis and to do also proper due diligence analysis before we enter into a new factory or country, and to share this information within different stakeholders. So that's also in our auditing program, we're using a software to conduct audit reports, which are shared directly with our suppliers, who then can log in into the software and answer their efforts to improve, to share evidence on how they are improving and how they are developing their corrective action plans. And so we are in continuous communication through this platform.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Again, a lot of points that we can come back to. I'll come to Verity just in a second, but before I do, just a reminder that please be submitting your questions or thinking about your questions. Some brilliant questions have come in already, but I'll be putting them to the panel a little bit later on. And also, I know that there have been some technical problems. The sound seems to be dropping off for some of you. Do stick with us, please. The technology is amazing, but it's only amazing when it works properly. But typically, once we get going, it does remain very stable. But we will, of course, be sharing the recording once the webinar is over. So you will get a chance to listen to it in full in the future, and also share with your colleagues. Okay, Verity, let me turn to you. Similar question to Vera. What are you doing to highlight human rights and labour abuses in your operations and supply chains? And how does all auditing help you right now? Verity, rather.
Right. Hi, Ian. Thank you very much. I mean, I think it sort of really depends also on what we actually mean by auditing here. So I think so far, you know, maybe the focus in this discussion has been on your kind of traditional factory style audits, which certainly we do with our non-agricultural suppliers. So whether it's suppliers of filter tips or cigarettes or batteries for vapor devices, that's where you've got a sort of manufacturing environment that is more suited to your sort of audit framework. Whereas one of the, for our organization, I expect that Gabby will have some of the same kind of things to talk about, is where you have an agricultural supply chain with a large farmer base, your sort of factory style audit is obviously not the kind of suitable approach there, because I think, you know, that's, you know, particularly the farms that we are sourcing from in our supply chain, we have over 90,000 directly contracted farmers. So they have direct contracts with a BAT company. And then there's about another 250,000 farmers who supply third party suppliers that we buy from. So, you know, though, and the majority of those farmers are smallholders. So we're not talking your sort of big plantations with lots and lots of workers, lots of hired laborers, which I think is sort of what maybe a lot of people picture with tobacco farming in that kind of US style. What we're talking about is smallholder family farms, often of less than a hectare of land, where it is the farmer and his family working that land with very few hired laborers, very few workers. They might have one or two people coming in during harvest season, hired quite informally, but it's certainly not your type of environment that you could do a traditional audit in. So I think that's where you really have to start looking at alternative ways to try and identify human rights issues and violations. So farm monitoring is one approach, and that is something that we have always done as an organization with our directly contracted farmers. So we have field technicians who visit the farmers on a regular basis throughout the growing season. So they'll be at the farms at least once a month throughout the growing season to discuss the growing techniques with the farmers, discuss different agronomy practices, but also talk around human rights issues, and for them to observe what is going on the farm to make sure that the farmers are adhering to our standards. Now, as I said, that is something that we've long been doing, but I think the sort of game changer has been in the technology space in the last few years, is where we can do that digitally. So I think digital is not necessarily the solution, but it's certainly a very important tool when it comes to this. You know, for starters, it means that our field technicians can spend more time with the farmers and less time filling out paperwork, doing it all manually. They have all the monitoring they need to do on a handheld mobile device, so they can do that as they're going along in the farms and not have to fill out endless paperwork. But it also means that any issues get flagged up straight away. So we have sort of red flags within the system. So if, for instance, child labour violations are found, or something that maybe indicates some kind of bonded labour for farm workers, then that will immediately send an alert right to us here globally. So we have a global team that monitors that within the supply chain. I will usually be contacted as a human rights subject matter expert within the business to help work on the sort of investigation and the remediation and provide advice. So I think that's where digital is really key. But then what we're really talking about here is trying to identify, you know, violations, for example, once they've happened. So I think, you know, there is obviously always a place for that, and you always need to be checking and doing that monitoring. But I think alongside that, as particularly in high risk agricultural sector, is also trying to think about and trying to understand what are the underlying root causes for these issues. And I think that's where we might hope that we might move the needle a lot further. It's particularly in farming, you know, the primary root cause for any kind of human rights issues is most likely to be linked to poverty. And so I think that's where a lot of the work that we're doing around farmer livelihoods really comes in, to try and address those underlying root causes. If farmers have a good income, a good standard of living, they're not going to be wanting to use their children as free family labour on the farm. They're going to want to send their children to school. And that is really, I think, where it's about that sort of combination of the reactive approach of the monitoring, trying to obviously spot what's happening now, check conditions on the ground, but then also that sort of wider engagement, trying to identify the root causes and then work on those. And something else that we've recently started doing is very, very bespoke human rights impact assessment. So that's working with a specialist who really designs that impact assessment to be very bespoke for the particular environment, for the particular country or area that we are sourcing from. We are doing them on an industry level, so working with our competitors on these, because we're often obviously sourcing from many of the same areas, from many of the same tobacco farmers and suppliers. And I think what we're learning from those impact assessments is that circumstances, whilst there's sort of lots of universal knowns that exist within different sectors, I think there's also so many things that are so unique and so specific to particular cultures, to particular areas, to particular circumstances. And that's where that really finding out that underlying information and those root causes then helps us to actually focus and prioritize our efforts in the right areas, and not just taking a one-size-fits-all approach.
Thanks, Verity. That's great. It strikes me that technology then really allows you to engage with your smallholder farmers. I mean, clearly 90,000 direct contracts and then a further 250,000 other smallholders in your supply chain. It's not feasible for you to be auditing these guys in the traditional sense, but I imagine the technology that you can roll out to them, that's a game changer for you.
Yes, yeah. I mean, like I said, it's not the solution, it's the tool. You know, it's the tool that's enabling us to do better what we've always done. The thing is with our field technicians, you know, these are the people who are local to the communities, they live within those communities, they know the farmers very well. They are, you know, our frontline people. They are, you know, the direct engagement with the farmers on that sort of regular basis. You know, they are our eyes and ears. So we do rely on them a lot to record stuff. But I think something Terry was saying earlier, I think that you can give them the technology, you can give them all the questions that they need to ask, but training and education within that is absolutely key. I think that, you know, it's not just about asking the questions that we tell them they need to ask, or checking the things that the digital handset says they've got to tick off. It's about really getting them to understand, you know, what we really mean by these issues. You know, modern slavery is quite a hard term for people to get their heads around. It's maybe not even as easy as something like child labour. Child labour is a little bit more straightforward. You understand the sort of the factors there. Are kids going to school? How old are they? What kind of tasks are they involved in? Whereas modern slavery, it's a lot harder for people to understand. And we met with one of our partners recently, Hope for Justice, who run the multi-stakeholder group Slave Free Alliance. And they were talking about most people who are victims of forced labour or modern slavery wouldn't even recognize that themselves. So they, if you said to them, are you a victim of forced labor, are you a victim of modern slavery, they would probably say no. And then it's more about, okay, how are the things that you can sort of tease out, and not having closed questions, having more open questions. What are the kind of signs you can spot? What are those little indicators? And as Terry said, I think that's where the training and education is key. So making sure our field techs are armed, not only with the technology as that tool for them, but then with the knowledge and understanding to really be able to spot these things.
Okay, thank you very much, Verity. Let me turn now to Gabby. Thank you very much for your patience. Let me put that question to you then. What are you doing to highlight human rights and labour abuses in your operations and supply chains? And what is auditing doing to help right now? Gabby.
Okay, thanks, Ian. I did want to say that I really enjoyed your introduction. And I think there's an awful lot of auditor bashing happening. It's become a bit of a national sport, but I've found out a lot of really useful things through audits, and I think that they have to be thought of as a tool, and one of a few different tools that you can use. So I guess that would be the first thing that I'd say, is that we do rely on audits for quite a lot of stuff, but they're not the only thing that we need. And so my second point would be that audits are not static, and that we can play with them and use them in unconventional ways, or in ways that work for specific countries or specific supply chains. So for example, something that we've started to do is kind of bolt onto our audits additional questionnaires or additional focus groups around recruitment, because we know that in certain countries, and Malaysia and Thailand have been focused for us so far, we want to understand how migrant workers have ended up in those factories, what kind of conditions they're being employed in, what the recruitment journey looked like for them, any existing debt that they may have, and who they're in debt to, and what that debt looks like. And there is, you know, honestly speaking, there's no way that you're going to get through to that information just by having a conventional audit. But auditors are very skilled people, and I think for anyone who is extremely critical of audits, make sure that you've shadowed a really skilled auditor before you kind of are too critical of them, because especially in Thailand, you know, shadowing some of the auditors that we've worked with there, who have been doing this job for a really long time, their ability to get people to open up in those focus groups was fantastic. And we learned a lot through them. So I think, you know, use the audit, but play around with the format of it, and don't just treat it as something that's kind of unchanging over time. Another thing that kind of around using the audit framework, which is really worth doing, is that look at your code of conduct and what your code includes and whether it's appropriate for your supply chain. We recently reviewed our code, and we looked at it through a few different lenses. So we looked at it from a modern slavery angle and a recruitment angle and a recruitment fees angle, but we also worked with BSR and looked at it from a gender lens. And so we've included quite a few different questions in our audit scope. And the way that we work is that sometimes we accept ZX audits, but sometimes we insist on doing a Twinings audit, which is quite similar, but we've adapted it a bit, and it has a bit more rigor in areas that we're concerned about. So be flexible and be creative. And then the next thing I'd say is that audits do not need to be I don't think they should be the only tool in your box. So at Twinings, and Ovaltine, with the same company, obviously tea is the first thing that springs to people's minds, and herbs, but we have other raw materials. We also have a lot of packaging factories in our own operations. So we use audits for first tier of our supply chain for factories, but there's no way, and Verity was saying this, there's no way that that's going to be a useful tool in a tea estate. It just wouldn't fit. So we've developed our own assessment called the Twinings Community Needs Assessment, the TTNA. And the idea is to get down to community-wide issues and try and understand the drivers of some of the really entrenched problems that you can come across. And again, Verity spoke to this as well. If you're coming across systemic human rights abuses, whether that's child marriage or trafficking of young women, you know what's sitting behind that, there's no point trying to tackle that issue unless you understand what's causing it. So the goal of the TCNA is to try and kind of get down to what's sitting behind some of the issues that you might come across in a tea estate or in a herb supply chain. And then off the back of that, the programs that we then develop seek to address those kind of core issues. And then the hope is that when we do our next round of a TCNA, we would see progress. So to give two very brief examples, we've worked with UNICEF in Assam on adolescent girls groups, and the purpose of those groups is to there are a lot of purposes of those groups, and they include young women's health and empowerment, but also to create a protective environment for young women so that if they are at risk of trafficking, there are safeguards around them and the community can kind of jump in and take the action that they need to take. And what we are seeing from that is that it is preventing cases of child marriage. It is preventing cases of trafficking of young women into urban centres. And then another one that I would flag up is in Sri Lanka, we work with CARE on CDFs, community dialogue forums. And the role of those forums is to kind of address the issue of just a real lack of an effective grievance mechanism. And if workers can't flag up what the issues are to them, how are you ever really going to get to the bottom of what they're experiencing? So there's quite a lot of resource and quite a lot of time that goes into building those, but ultimately you can actually start to get a really clear picture of what workers' grievances are. And it can really change the tide of how workers and management talk to each other. And then the final thing that I would say would be around training, and I think this everybody has flagged this up. An audit is only a piece of paper unless you know what you want to do with it. And it takes quite a lot of time to be able to understand what you're reading in an audit or a report and to see what the red flag issues are. I think of everybody talking, we're the least advanced in terms of tech, but I do think that we have a team who's really skilled at knowing what might be sitting behind a certain symptom that you see in an audit. So it's about having a really well-trained team yourself, but then also working with your suppliers and training them. And if you want to really kind of get to the bottom of an issue as complicated as recruitment, for example, in Malaysia, doing a whole bunch of audits is not really going to achieve anything. But what might achieve something is doing detailed investigations with really fantastic auditors, then going in, training your suppliers on what responsible recruitment looks like, and then revisiting. So it becomes a bit more of a kind of an iterative process.
Thank you very much indeed. Let me put a question that's coming from our listeners to you. It touches on things that you mentioned in your remarks just now. Do you have a mechanism that balances cultural norms and beliefs with apparent human rights violations?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. Well, this has been an interesting one with our TCNA, so the Twinings assessment that we have for estates, for tea estates, and then also we're rolling it out increasingly in herb supply chains. And those supply chains are so broad, so they vary from Darjeeling and Assam through to Kenya and Malawi, Indonesia, China, and then recently I've been looking at herbs in Croatia and in Egypt. And of course, you're not going to be asking the same questions. So I think that the key thing there is to have somebody doing those assessments who knows the local context. So we have a team on the ground, and my Kenyan colleague does all of our assessments in Kenya and Malawi, and she really understands the local context. And you can bet that when she's doing a TCNA, it looks very, very different to my Indian colleagues, one of whom actually grew up on a tea estate. So I would say it's about the people. I think that it's necessary to kind of have a framework which can be replicated so that you can kind of have that objectivity and make sure that you're covering all bases, but then you need an intelligent person to be asking the questions on the ground.
Sure. Okay, context is king after all. Okay, thank you very much indeed. Terry, let me come back to you. We've had a lot of questions about night visits. It's been the most popular topic so far. question we've had in particular with night visits and also unannounced audits. The striker question is very valuable, but to what extent do you have to guard against nibbling at community trust and cohesion by sort of sowing level of doubt within a community in which your factory sits? If you're asking questions about the factory, inevitably there's potentially seeds of mistrust may well be sown. How do you counter that, Terry?
Good question. Audits are complicated, and auditors, a good auditor knows how to ask the questions in a way to to get information back from who they're asking the questions for. So the two things involved. So the night audit, when we actually send our auditor to do this, nobody knows we're there. You know, so we're going in, it's unannounced. We're just observing from the outside. We're not going in. That's just a step that we take to if there is a suspect of some issues going on. We can go in there if the client thinks that maybe they're working too many shifts, too many hours. It's a way to actually observe and see if this is happening, and then go back to the factory and have them, you know, give their answers on it without knowing you were there the first time. As for the neighborhood audits, again, that's a little twist on what we do. And it would just be almost like going into, you know, go having lunch and just, seeing whoever's in there and say, oh, what do you see? A lot of people coming and going there. It's not anything formal. You're trying to do it in a way to just kind of get some information without, without annoying the neighborhood. I don't know how else to put it, but you're just, you know, when you're trying to get information or trying to build someone's trust or just trying to get the truth out of someone, you need to sometimes pose questions in a way that does not make them feel be intimidated to answer you or feel like they don't want to give the wrong answer. You need to try to make them feel comfortable and truthful. So that's what we do. And that's, again, all part of good training for the auditors to be comfortable with those questions and those scenarios and to understand the red flags, to understand, the different signs and behavioral issues with human trafficking and slave labor while they're on site, but also during these external kind of visits or checks, to be able to pose things in a certain way to get the information we need.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks very much, Jade. Okay, we've got a lot of questions, and I want to put as many of them to our panel as possible. So panelists, can you please limit yourself to 1 minute answers from this point on? I will be cutting down after a minute because I want to try and get through as many questions as possible. Our next question, best practices for helping employees feel comfortable and safe in raising concerns about how they've been treated. It moves on from what Terry just said. Vera, do you want to answer that one? What's best practice for helping employees feel comfortable and safe when they're raising concerns?
Yes, there's different ways. So one of them is doing the audit. The more you appear as an auditor, so for instance, in Aldo, we have our own auditors. We also have the third-party auditors. But we only have a selected branch of auditors in which we have a very close collaboration on training, on our procedures, and on our guidelines. And to establish a relation with the factory is very important, that they trust us, that they have a regular seeing us around. So this is one thing of our main task our main way to make feel employees comfortable. There's also many methodologies during the audit, during the selection of the employees, to be very careful that they feel that it's voluntary, that all the information is confidential, to give them proper information of what they're allowed to, or that they can feel very, very comfortable during the audit. We used to do also like very unofficial interviews, so to go, for instance, out for a cigarette and then everyone feels more comfortable. In certain countries, we also, if the employee wants that, we invite other people to join the interview so that we make sure that it's very comfortable for everybody and that nobody is obliged to join any interview or any conversation. We also have different grievance mechanisms like hotlines that are available for the employees to use in the case that they don't feel comfortable during the audit, so that they can do it afterwards or at any time. And also trainings that we provide, not only for the factory managers, also for the employees, that where they can also feel comfortable to share with us.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, next question. How can companies prioritize auditing? How do you decide which suppliers to audit? Verity, let's come to you for that one.
So I think this works best probably for our non-agricultural side, for the farm, so for basically all the supplies of our sort of non-agricultural direct materials and our indirect goods and services. So we started using Verisk Maplecroft. I don't know if people are aware of, they developed sort of data analytics for human rights indices crossing lots and lots and lots of different issues. So we use that independent human rights data in their indices to run risk assessments on our entire supplier base. We are talking a massive number of suppliers here. It's 30 to 40,000 suppliers worldwide. So clearly we're not going to be able to audit them all in a single year. So we use those risk assessments to prioritize. And they're really helping us not only in sort of looking at, okay, where we need to focus in terms of the kind of countries, the high risk countries that our suppliers operate in, but then especially when it's looking at the indirect space. So whether that's goods and services in terms of, you know, your logistics supplier, your facilities management, or, you know, IT support or professional services, whatever that may be, it's looking at those categories that we need to start moving our audits into. So traditionally the audits were focused on the direct materials supply chain, and we're gradually moving more to directs, but very much taking a risk-based approach. So for example, we've identified facilities management as a high risk area in that indirect space through those risk assessments, and that's helping us prioritize. So I think they can't tell you, the risk assessments obviously can't tell you where actual issues are, but they can certainly help you look at where you need to focus your efforts.
Okay, thanks very much, Verity.
Can I join in on that one, Ian, really quickly? Because
very good. 20-second answer, please, because I've got a lot of questions to answer.
Sure. So, because there's a practical answer, the way that we prioritise which first-tier suppliers we're going to audit is that we look at four things. We look at how vulnerable the workers are, and that's based on if there are migrant workers, temporary workers, skewed towards one gender. We look at our leverage as a business, so how much the value of our business is. We look at the country and we look at the product type. So we have an algorithm that we stick that into. It gives us a priority and we audit what's high priority, and that's roughly a third of our suppliers.
Great, thank you very much indeed. I was actually gonna come to you, Gabby, a quick question on pausing audits. Some companies pausing audits for compliant suppliers who are willing to enter into long-term programs. Have you considered doing that approach?
No.
Why not?
No. It's kind of it's part and parcel of working with us. We do space audits based on how well suppliers have done in the previous audit. So it could be up to 3 years between audits if we're very confident about supplier, or 6 months if we are concerned. But we would never just decline to audit full stop.
Okay, very clear. Access for auditing is very important. Terry, could you consider what's the challenges around ensuring auditors get access and so they're able to do proper independent audits? What are the challenges around that and how do you solve them?
Oh, geez. So, yeah. So being a previous auditor myself, it's a challenge, because if a factory denies you access to certain areas, usually when someone denies you access, it's because they're trying to hide something. What we try to do, and we hope our clients also do this, is that to realize that auditing is a tool, and auditing should just be the first step in your relationship with your factory. So if that is the stance of the client, and they are trying to be partners with the factory, what we try to do is we try to convince the factory that, you need to let us have access to everything. We don't, you won't be penalized for, that's not the right word. The more access that we have, the more of a picture we can paint for your client. And if your client wants to be partners with you, they need the information and able to move forward and create a better working environment in your factory with you and a better partnership with you. So that's kind of the stance that we try to take. Of course, as long as that's the client's stance as well. But it's tricky. I mean, there's sometimes they just don't want to let you come into places, and we have to report that and quote assume that there's something that they have to hide, because we cannot validate what we can't see.
Sure. Okay, thank you. Thanks very much indeed. Vera, turning to you, question on supplier capacity. How do you find supplier capacity for mediation of non-compliant issues? What impact does that have on purchasing? Do you find that you have to change your suppliers if they don't have the capacity to remediate? And how do you work that with your purchasing colleagues?
Yeah, so as I said, we have a very deep internal process in which we share the social compliance status within other many other statuses of each supplier. So we sit down together and there are different team members, not only social compliance, so we are adding product compliance, sourcing, product development, and sitting down on what is the status quo and what do we plan with further, so that we really ensure that our responsible purchasing practices are in place and we do not have any negative effect on the working conditions at our factories. This has been already implemented for approximately 1 year, and it's working very good, in which we are sharing the challenges of being of the social compliance audits within internal departments so that the decisions that we take are the right ones.
Thank you very much indeed.
Can I add something real quick, Ian?
Yeah, sure. 20 seconds.
So what, you know, when our auditors look for red flags and just in general, a red flag of possible human rights violations, you know, if your factory is giving you really cheap prices, if it seems too good to be true, then it often is. Because the corners are being cut somewhere, and usually it's with the workers. And if they're over-promising on delivery dates, again, that leads to them rushing forced labor, forced overtime. So your internal teams also need to be educated that if things seem too good to be true, or if prices seem, you know, wow, these are, you know, really too good to be true, there's something being cut somewhere along the way. So,
sure. Thank you. Vera, let me come back to you. I know, Vera, you need to leave us a little bit early. So I just wanted to ask a final question to you. And it's around local people, local audits, local auditors. This comes up a lot and it's being asked a number of times from our audience this afternoon. If you have local people doing your auditing in different parts of the world, how do you prevent or intercept corruption with the auditors? That's something which our questioners come across a lot. So the prevention of auditing when the auditor and the factory owner know each other well and there's a relationship there that perhaps isn't conducive to a rigorous audit. Vera.
Yeah, this is a very challenging question also, and a big challenge for all brands and all third-party companies and everybody that is involved in this industry. So we have a very close contact with the factories as well as with our third-party companies doing the audits. We have a huge amount of trainings, awareness sessions to try to mitigate this problem and to be aware of what happens. It's definitely a zero tolerance aspect in our case. So in case a factory gets bribes an auditor or an auditor propose that to the factory, that for us a zero tolerance, and we stop right away. So we are really encouraging our factories to raise challenges and problems directly to us, and that's why also we have the hotline to try to get all the information. And it's a continuous work that we do with everyone involved in the industry. So I don't think there is a simple solution for this, and unfortunately it's there, and we have all to do with that. And the only thing that we do, the biggest thing that we do is through policies and trainings and awareness session. And again, having a close contact with the people that are involved.
Sure. Well, thank you very much indeed. A linked question, another challenge or another potential problem from auditing is inadvertently driving supply chain challenges underground. They just get hidden away away from the auditing process. Gabby, what are the key ways to avoid this when you're approaching an audit?
Oh, it's a very good question, and it's really, really, really challenging. And I think that, I have had some times when I've kind of lain awake at night and wondered if a specific audit that we looked at had a negative impact and had meant that the factory had hidden issues, perhaps by firing workers, or and it should worry people. I suppose the key thing is that it needs to have a very human face. And we do sometimes talk to factories who say that they've been, we're lucky, we're a slightly smaller brand, but they've been audited by a really big brand. It's been extremely tick box. They haven't really had a person they can interface with afterwards, only a system. And I think that that can be very alienating if you're the person who's responsible for remediation in the factory. So you do need people who can talk to suppliers. If you're concerned about the findings of that audit, follow it up with a phone call and talk things through before going in really hard and insisting on remediation of some very entrenched and complicated issues.
Fine. Terry, do you want to jump in on that as well?
Yeah, so, there's, you know, the audit, again, like I said before, the audit is the first step. And one of the ways that some of the services that we offer is to follow up audits with remediation services, where we can go in and help the factory work through some of their issues that are found, so that they can better the factory and get past some of these critical findings, you know, major and minor findings. But we would send in a different team to do a re-audit if needed. But we work with the clients and the brands to make sure the audit works for them and it's customized for their business. So when we are going in there, we're not just doing a cookie cutter audit. We're doing it based on what the client's needs and requirements are. I don't remember what the question was. I think I answered it.
I think you answered it quite well. Verity, let me put a quick question to you. We're getting towards the end of our time, but Verity, I'd like you to answer this one. How can you be transparent and at the same time protect the identity of interviewees when you've got employee hotlines and grievance mechanisms? How do you get the balance of transparency and protecting identity of interviewees?
I mean, I think in terms of sort of hotlines, in terms of we have our sort of speak up hotlines that are open to both our own employees and to suppliers and their workers. I think that's about, you know, that confidentiality piece has to be so emphasized both in the sort of communications of those channels, but in also then this sort of whole culture that exists around it. So it's sort of creating that culture of confidence, of trust, and following through on that. So, you know, we guarantee confidentiality in terms of our speak up. That comes straight from our chief executive. He gives his personal assurance of that. But then it's also making it available for people to report anonymously if they wish. And certainly in some cultures, we certainly found that anonymous reporting is more common in certain countries than others, often because of cultural issues where traditionally people have felt unsafe reporting things without hiding their identity. So it's about assuring that sort of level of confidentiality and then sort of following through, but then also having anonymous channels available. And I think one of the things we try and do is we actually, you know, sort of highlight, okay, this is a great thing when we've seen an increase in the number of issues reported to our speak up channels. And we might do case studies on the kind of things that come up and how they were investigated and how they were addressed. Obviously, protecting people's identities within those case studies. But by showing those sort of stories, it gets people more comfortable with knowing, actually, I feel more trusting that I can report this and this will be investigated. And it's sort of, it's about building that culture, I think, over time.
Okay. Yes, jump in, please, Terry.
Ian, yeah. So I wanted to say, you know, another approach that we take is during the interview process, we use that as an entry point to get to get information about the employees there, maybe a callback number, so that we can do what we do is a proactive callback service after the audit, maybe a few days or a week after, and we do it at the workers' time and day of their choosing. And we just want to make sure that after we have left the facility, maybe a couple days later, that the factory hasn't retaliated against them or hasn't done anything to them once we left, based on them doing the interviews with us. So we try to gather that information as well to send back to the client.
Okay, thank you. I would have put a question in a second to all our panel as a way of wrapping up, and that is, what is the ultimate goal of auditing, and particularly in the human rights context? But I'd like to turn to Gabby very quickly for a quick question on pre-competitive collaboration. How much do you cooperate in your auditing with your competitors and share results? And what are the challenges around that right now, Gabby?
Yeah, not as much as we should, I think. I guess the challenge is being able to map one another's supply chains. I think AIM Progress has been really helpful, and we are a member of AIM Progress, and that's probably the best way to do this right now. And then I think it really depends on the industry. So in tea, we're members of Ethical Tea Partnership. That's extremely helpful. Our supply list is shared with them. In herbs, it's a bit of a new frontier. So I would say that the key way to do that is to make sure that you find a membership organization who has that as a goal. But it is really, really tricky. And I do come up against that question quite a lot. Sure. When we have audit findings that we're concerned about.
I guess there's no easy way to take that forward.
Sadly not, no, but we do need to keep trying.
Indeed. Okay, as I said, we are coming towards the end of our time. I'd like to put the final question to all of our panel then in turn, and perhaps Verity, to you first. What for you is the ultimate goal of auditing in terms of human rights and more broadly? Is it self-compliance, or is it simply an ongoing process? Verity.
I think it's very much an ongoing process, and I really chime with what Gabby said earlier about, you know, audit frameworks don't just stand still. I think they are constantly evolving. As we learn more, as we get more experience, as our suppliers get more experienced, I think that flexibility is absolutely key. Like I said, I think, you know, audits are just one part of that sort of wider ecosystem of what you're doing. It might be, you know, your first stage in terms of trying to identify issues. But then, as I said, I think there's a lot more that needs to happen around that, whether that's follow-up investigations, whether that's wider community investigations or an engagement, and whether that's human rights impact assessments. So yeah, it's very much an ongoing and evolving process. And I think all of us can talk to probably over our careers of how much these things have changed already. You know, when I look back at, you know, when I started looking at this area over 10 years ago, audits looked very, very, very different. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the progress that's happened already. And I think that that pace of that is hopefully going to increase. And we're going to maybe start seeing less of sort of standardized one size fits all audits, and maybe more of an approach to helping to adapt, to be a little bit more flexible, looking at the different circumstances that suppliers are in designing those audits for different suppliers and environments.
Okay, thank you. Gabby, same to you then. What's the ultimate goal of auditing?
I think it's a means towards an end, and the end should be driving improvements in our supply chains. And I think that's a really helpful goal to keep in mind. Otherwise, we can get very lost in process and databases and emails. And actually, what we really want to do is bring standards up.
Fine. Thank you very much. Terry, final question again to you. So for you, what's the ultimate goal of auditing? Is it self-compliance? Is it an ongoing process? How do you see it?
Yeah, so you know, we take the approach, you know, that that auditing is constantly changing. So, you know, at KEMA, we have the ability to adapt the audits to meet your needs. And the client's needs change. You know, every couple of years, your audit program might need to change based on what is happening. Again, I've seen a lot of changes in the last 27 plus years, but the whole goal at the end is to be able to do an audit that gives your company the information that you need The audit, the service provider needs to be able to collect the data so that you can use that data to improve your supply chain and have complete transparency in your supply chain. And just remember that auditing is the first step. If you stop there, you're only getting part of the picture. You know, your audit is your first step, and then you need to do follow-up and continuous improvement and partnership with your factory. If you want to have a good factory and you want to prevent human rights violations from happening in your supply chain.
Indeed. Well, I'm going to steal a comment that's been made by one of our listeners. You cannot fatten a pig by weighing it again and again. It's what you do in that matters most. So thank you very much for our listener who sent that in. I'm going to stop the discussion now as we've run out of time. I would like to thank our panel very much for their time and insight today. So to Terry, to Vera, to Gabby, and to Verity, it's been a fantastic discussion. Thank you so much for all your questions. It's been an unprecedented level of questions, and I hope we managed to get yours answered. Apologies if we didn't. My thanks in particular to Kima for sponsoring today's webinar. Don't forget that many similar issues will be discussed by experts at the Innovation Forum Ethical Trade and Human Rights Conference in London on the 18th and 19th of March. We'll also be in New York later in the spring on 5th and 6th of May to debate these issues. And you can get a launch discount conference pass with up to $500 off the full price if you register before Friday the 13th next week. We'll be in touch with a recording of this webinar so you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. But for now, I hope you found the past hour interesting. I've been Ian Welsh, and thank you very much indeed for your time.